I've debated somewhat on how to prepare for sermons, because as a whole, I have a habit of not writing them out fully. They're still rough notes if you ever look on them online. And part of it is because once you start doing something a certain way, it's often hard to change it. Plus, I like the idea that somebody could potentially not listen to the sermon and still kind of get the points. Whereas if I do, I've thought of going like bullet lines, because that's really all I would need to help me focus on certain things. And sometimes actually having it written out trips you up, because you go back and you want to make sure you don't miss this point or miss that point, whereas bullets would make it easy. This sermon is kind of a hard sermon for me because it's something where, you know how sometimes you get a concept and when you try to put it into words, you don't think you quite have it? So I apologize ahead of time. I've written them out like I normally do and stuff, and I apologize ahead of time because it's just something as I was driving one day, and I don't even want to try to think what was the genesis of the thought, because then I might be sharing something I shouldn't with people. But it just hit me. Well, the title of this hit me, which is, we are comfortable in our misery. We are comfortable in our misery. And I can tell, Camille, that you already have an idea of where this is going, but it just had to do with a situation. Like I said, I don't want to see now I'm going to try to zone into it mentally, and I don't want to. I had a situation where like the first example I have on my notes here is, a lot of us have known, say, a woman whose husband is beating her. But no matter how many times she has to wear the sunglasses, or how many times she has to think of some excuse for a break or a bruise, she never leaves the guy. Just never leaves the guy. And to top it off, sometimes when the police finally have enough evidence to go after the guy themselves, you'll hear these stories of how the woman physically defends the guy as they're trying to cart him out. And we scratch our heads. And don't get me wrong, one thing that I think is very important, I hate having to put caveats on, but this is not blame the victim. This is not blame the victim. But the fact is, we scratch our heads. We say, why wouldn't she be smart enough to just boot him? Just get out of there, run away, do whatever. And it's not the purpose of this sermon to discuss why, but just because I think, as adults, we all kind of, at least, hopefully not many of us have personally experienced it, but we've probably all seen it either personally or in the news. And it doesn't just happen with women. There are men, too. It seems to me that often abusers and givers are somehow drawn together. Am I the only one who's noticed that? And the problem, of course, is the giver can never give enough. And depending on the relationship, it just slowly drains the humanity out of the person. And the abusers or the takers have a habit of basically trying to cordon off the outside world, not only perhaps to protect their own reputation, but because that way they increase their control. And it's not really unique to that. That's an extreme case where you scratch your heads. But how about like work? How many people have known of somebody who was just miserable at work? The job was terrible. The people, the management would yell at people. They didn't appreciate them. They didn't get paid enough and stuff. But they actually don't look for another job. You know, I think that the part of the reason that I'm unemployed, and don't get me wrong, I don't want to make it out like my former employer was some evil company, but the reality is that, well, I'll give you kind of a scenario. I, as a period of time for people familiar, I was going pretty much every other week to Minneapolis to try to make a client happy who was just never going to be happy. And it was about something else, but I had a call with the HR director. We had to go through a bunch of different, the department. My department had 250 plus people, so you always had something that was worth discussing. Luckily, not usually problems, just procedures, that kind of stuff. And during the conversation, she asked me how I was. And one thing I'll tell you right now, I'll sugarcoat something. I'll even avoid a question if I really don't want to answer it, but I'm not going to lie. And my response to her was, I am miserable. Just like that, I am miserable. And I was. I think I might have actually been sitting, I had just gotten back to the hotel room, I think I might have been sitting on the hotel floor with the lights out, not intentionally, but that was kind of the whole miserable mood. But ask Michelle, when she would find something online that might fit what I could do, do you think I applied for it? I didn't. No, I mean, maybe a couple times, but as a whole, I didn't. Now, in fairness, going back to the abused woman or to me not applying for jobs, there are extenuating circumstances. For instance, the woman might really have no way, leaving might mean on the street, not feeding her kids. Doesn't mean she shouldn't, but the fact is there are, and with me, a lot of times when you have a really crappy job, you're also working massive hours. And I don't know about you, when you get done with the day, you just want to collapse. You don't want to go do applications. So there are extenuating circumstances. But the fact is, I was comfortable in my misery, as is a woman. Now, I don't know if those hit home, but there are other examples. For instance, how many people have known of a drug user whose poison of choice is totally taking out their body in their life? And they are an emotional wreck. But that same person would never consider going to an AA meeting or the equivalent, say, Narcotics Anonymous. Never would consider going into treatment. And the only temporary way of escaping their agony in life is to use greater amounts of the drug, only, of course, once the high wears off, to have the low be even lower. It's just the way it is. But they won't go for treatment. Or how about the overweight person who has just huffed and puffed up some stairs and then goes to McDonald's, orders double quarter pounders, a large fry, and a Diet Coke. Huge. I'm sorry, not Diet Coke, regular Coke. Huge. And after they wolf that down, they devour a McFlurry, right? M&M's, who's Oreos? They devour it, and then they go home, plop on their couch, turn the TV on, grab some chips and a beer. And of course, they just huffed and puffed. And the phone rings, and they get their friend on, and they say to their friend about how they feel lousy, that their doctor thinks that they have type 2 diabetes, and work doesn't understand why they're sick so much. But they don't do anything to change it. They keep going. And again, extenuating circumstances. Drug addiction, physical drug addiction, is hard to throw. It's hard to throw. So it's not like, oh, they just need some little bit of willpower and it's done. And with food, when you look at somebody who's obese, they are hungry. There's no question. You know, it's not like that they are purposely stuffing their faces because they want Southwest Airlines to charge them for two seats. They truly are hungry. But the reality is, the abused woman, the person with a lousy job, the drug addict, the obese person, they are all comfortable in their misery. We complain, right? We want to be free of our chains. We might even make some attempts to change things. But ultimately, again, we, notice how it's not they now, it's we, are comfortable in our misery. I mean, if you think in a Christian context, how many of us here, you don't have to raise your hand, don't pray enough? But we know. See, you didn't have to, but I'll raise my hand. Since Heidi was willing to speak up, I'm willing to speak up. How many of us don't spend enough time in Scripture? How many of us feel that spiritual hole? But when it comes time to change it, do we adjust our schedules? Do we maybe get up a little earlier in the morning, watch a little less TV? Do we do it? No. No, because ultimately, even though we're going to make it through the pearly gates, we too, you know, it's easy to look at other people, we too are comfortable in our misery. We've got a, I don't want to say a good thing going, but we've got something going. We're used to the rut. Why take the chance of trying to get out of the rut? So when we look at the other ones, it's too easy to try to exclude ourselves. But again, like I said, we'll complain. We want to be free of our chains. We'll attempt to make little changes. But really, our actions prove that we are comfortable in our misery. Now, when I think of spiritual misery, because it's easy to think of physical misery, but when I think of spiritual misery, one reference comes to mind. I've brought this up for other reasons too, but let's turn to Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. And this may seem a strange one to some people, but hopefully after we get through it, it's long, but I think worth it. Once we get to the end, hopefully once I give you kind of a list based on it, you'll understand what I mean. So Romans 1, verses 18 through 32. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. I'm a big fan of Romans, although it can be confusing at points. I don't think that part's confusing. Anybody confused about what Paul's saying there? So just how comfortable were those people in their spiritual misery? They clearly perceived God's eternal power and divine nature. It says that. They clearly perceived God's eternal power and divine nature, but they did not honor him. They did not thank him. They became futile in their thinking. Their hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for idols. They have been given up to their lusts. They dishonor their bodies. They exchange the truth about God for a lie. They worshiped and served the creature instead of the Creator. They have been given up to dishonorable passions. They did not acknowledge God. They have been given up to a debased mind. They do what ought not to be done. They are filled with all manner of unrighteousness. They know that they should die for what they do, but they still do them, and they give approval to people who do the same things that they do. A sign of spiritual health and comfort in spiritual misery are our fruits, are they not? How do these folks rate? Well, you agree that they're clearly spiritually miserable, And you get to the end of that section, they're basically encouraging other people to do it. Hey, join me in this. Now, it's true that the verses don't technically say that they are spiritually miserable and comfortable with it, but there's no way, short of literally severing the conscience that God has given every one of us, short of actually severing that. And I do believe it. That's what I think actually is the unpardonable sin. It's when you truly go so far that God has to admit you are unreachable. I think it might be in Acts 2. No, actually be 7. When Stephen gets stoned, is it 7? Acts 7? But he makes a comment about how they basically kept rejecting the Holy Spirit just like their fathers, I suppose, did. That at some point God tries and tries and tries. But short of doing that, short of cutting your conscience off, you feel uncomfortable. God has given that as a gift. They feel uncomfortable. So we see their spiritual need. We know that they know better, but they're still comfortable with it, and they're pursuing it even more. Now, not only do they embrace their condition, but, and I think this is the kind of the scary thing, one part of it says that it almost said like they think of new ways to do it too, right? And can you think even in the modern world today how that's done? The internet comes out, and what's the biggest thing on the internet? That's a new way for do pornography, right? Or gambling or whatever. Television. Aren't they always trying to figure out some new way to cross the boundary? You know, if they do it on HBO, then they can show stuff that they wouldn't. There's like some new series coming out, and they're like, well, the U.S. series will not have the nudity, but luckily they're still going to film it, so when they show it over in Europe, they can. Doing whatever they can to increase their spiritual misery that they're then comfortable in. Now, there are multiple ways to react when you do finally realize you are spiritually miserable. One is to damn those who have the audacity to let you know it. And it's not that people actually have to be in your face. Sometimes it's just because you won't do what they do. Take Jesus. Their reaction to Jesus was because he made them feel uncomfortable. Some because, yes, they heard his words. But I'd say most because he himself and the way he behaved proved their need, and they didn't want to hear it. And they didn't want to hear it. Another one is to become a proponent, we just talked about that, of your evil behavior. You know, for instance, giving approval to those who do the same things. Or, let's turn to Luke 18:9 through 14 and look at another example of how we can react, or how an individual can react when they realize they are spiritually miserable. Luke 18:9 through 14. What's interesting about this one is that it actually gives us an example of how not to react and how to react. So 9, and we're looking at, 18, 9 through 14. 18, 9 through 14. He, being Jesus, also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Which, by the way, is another thing that you'll often see with people who are happy in their sin. They treat non-sinners as if they're stupid, and that somehow they're better because they enjoy everything in life, and look at that prude over there who won't go out drinking or whatever. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes and all that I get. But the tax collector, standing afar off, would not even lift his eyes up to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Now, the Pharisee was comfortable in his misery and proud of it, actually. But the tax collector accepted the reality of his condition and cried out to the only one who could solve it. He fully understood the truth of these Old Testament words, if I can get my fingers aligned. And Samuel said to the people, "Do not be afraid. You have done all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. And do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty." Now, Samuel was probably talking about idols, but we've talked before. Does an idol have to be something made out of wood or clay? Or no. In the tax collector understood that there's a good chance tax collectors back then almost always cheated people. Because that's how they made, I mean, and the Romans knew it because that's how they were supposed to collect it. They didn't just get a percentage. If they got you to pay $100 and your bill was only 80, they got to keep the 20. So guess what they were going to try to do? He had idols, and he knew that they were empty. He knew he had done evil. He knew he had been turning to empty things. He knew those empty things could not deliver, that only God could. Now that is one way to react to spiritual misery. As I mentioned before, even we Christians get comfortable in our spiritual misery. We know that we should change something. And the difference between us and those spoken of in Romans 1 is that, yes, we will still make it into heaven, but we'll do it in a much more half-hearted way than we really need to. So the question is, if you are in an unhealthy relationship, what are you doing to change it? Now, I'm not encouraging divorce for married folks, but as those of us who've been in bad relationships know, they don't magically heal themselves. And generally, unhealthy ones just become more unhealthy. What concrete steps, if you've got a bad relationship, are you taking to either resolve the issues or prove it can't be fixed? Isn't that it? Just force an answer, right? Is it going to work out or not? If you have a terrible job, what are you doing to change that? Now again, I'm not saying that you should just go up and quit, like a lot of young people seem to think is the solution. But really, is it better to have friends you can cry to than to put some effort into looking for a job where at least some mornings you can wake up and look forward to it? Now, I don't think, I was discussing with somebody else, I don't think that there's any job that every morning you wake up and you look forward to it. But wouldn't one out of four be good? And they are out there, right? If you use drugs or drink too much, what are you doing to change it? It may be true that you can't quit cold turkey, but would you rather keep spinning the chamber, pulling the trigger, and see what goes first? Your body, your friends, your family? Have you at least, if you've got that problem, have you at least gone to your Christian brothers and sisters and asked for help? I mean, can't you at least do that? If you're significantly overweight, what are you doing to change that? And I'm not suggesting, by the way, that you go run off and try another diet where you feel starved the whole time, and then after you start eating just what a normal human would eat, your weight shoots back up over where you started. But is the effort it would take to actually start ridding yourself of the weight that much worse than having your body progressively deteriorate? Because that's what will happen. It doesn't get better, just like relationships. And do you really want your medicine cabinet, because this is what also happens, to suddenly give Rite Aid a run for the money on who has more pills? I mean, when I sometimes see some elderly person's stash, that's what happens. And is that really better than the misery of not necessarily being able to eat ice cream as much as you want? If you are a Christian who's living with half of your foot in the world, what are you doing to change that? Are you satisfied with getting into heaven by the skin of your teeth as others around you who aren't Christians use your hypocritical example to excuse their comfort in misery in rejecting Christ? There are ramifications. There is nobody who's truly an island in this world. Whether you use drugs or get fat or live in an abusive relationship or act like a half-hearted Christian. And if you are a non-believer, what are you doing to change it? Sure, you can go the Richard Dawkins route and attack the truth that Romans says is clearly perceived. And not only that, you can pat yourself on the back telling you how much smarter you are than all those dumb Christians or Hindus or Muslims or whatever. I respect anybody who looks for truth. The other ones are wrong. But Dawkins isn't some smart dude because he has developed a living out of rejecting all semblance of truth. Or instead, if you're a non-believer, you can listen to the words of your Creator, and let's turn together in Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 11. Ezekiel is one of those books I always go the wrong direction for. Mm-hmm. Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 11. I brought this one up. I'd run into the longer section one time. And it remember the sermon I did that I said when God, and then I put in parentheses, finally speaks clearly? This is a case where I thought God finally spoke clearly, where we could learn, because God's nature is impossible to describe with finite words. They're always limited. But in this passage, you learn something about God that clears up all the other things that people might do to confuse you and make you think that God is some kind of harsh ogre. But this is what 33:11 says. Say to them, as I live, declares the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn back from your evil ways. For why will you die, O house of Israel? Why will you die? I mean, isn't that the simple question? Why will you die? When you have an alternative, why would you stay comfortable in your spiritual misery and die when God says here he doesn't want you to die? Victim, using the why will, victim, why will you continue to allow abuse? Unappreciated employee, why don't you fill out some job applications? Drug user, why do you destroy your body and those around you? Glutton, why do you trade the ability to enjoy God's world for a miserable spot on the couch? Hedonist, because I used examples, but ultimately that's what it comes down to. We all have. There were other items I could do, but then you'd be here another half an hour. And it would get too salacious, right? But hedonist, why do you exchange the truth of God for a lie? Christian, why do you keep dabbling with things that you supposedly gave up when you were born again? Non-believer, why will you die? God has no pleasure in your death. I say to all of us, let us stop being comfortable in our misery.